Mr. Macy reeled too.
I realised then that I had been wounded too. I could feel my back was rather painful and that there was some sticky stuff running down it. And I thought, well, I've caught up shrapnel as well. So the boatswain's mate was just coming too. And I said, well, come on, Pescod. We've got to get down to the chief's mess if it's still there. Get our wounds attended to. We attempted to go out of the SDO down the hatchway to get onto the lower decks. But the hatchway was full of smoke. There were flames coming up it. So we had to get up onto the bridge and go down on the port side from the signal sponson deck. And we got into the chief's mess, where the sick berth PO was, and I stripped off my jacket, and he went to town digging out the shrapnel in my back and wood splinters and one thing and the other and patching me up. And then, for the sake of interest, I held my jacket up to the light, and it just looked like a pepper pot. There had been so many splinters of wood and two larger pieces of shrapnel go into my back. It punctured my jacket. And really, it was quite badly torn, one thing and the other. And Pescod, the shrapnel was dug out of his leg. It was in his right upper thigh. And then we made our way out onto the upper deck, where by this time, having nothing to do and feeling very sorry for myself, very much of a coward, I sat down at the base of the forward funnel and felt full of self-pity and started to think to myself, well, I don't think I'm ever going to come out of this. There were a lot of morbid thoughts going through my head. There were dead bodies on the upper deck, which didn't help. And I looked around at the ship, which was in a hell of a mess, and that made me even more depressed. And this is why I say that when the captain sent for me to get up on the bridge, I was very thankful. I had something to do. It took my mind off these morbid thoughts. Well, now, I was talking about Surgeon Lieutenant Mooney getting the DSO for the very good job that he did in the water. Well, after 2 or 3 hours in the water, it started to get a bit cold. You must remember that this was the Mediterranean. Although in June it is quite warm in the Mediterranean, when you've had a few hours in it, it can begin to get a little bit cold, in spite of the fact that we were all packed in the oil fill to try and keep us as warm as possible. And cramp was beginning to set in. I myself felt hungry. I was thirsty, because remember, all that we'd had to drink were 2 tots of rum, and all that we'd had to eat with some corned beef sandwiches since early morning when we went into action. About 8 o'clock in the evening, a Red Cross seaplane landed on the sea about 200 yards away from us. And some of the ship's company immediately started swimming over to it, in spite of the fact that the captain ordered that wounded were to be taken on board first, if indeed they had come to pick some of us up. However, his voice was not heard. The people that were swimming towards it got there, and they were taken on board, and the plane flew off. This was about 8 o'clock, as I've already said. About 9:20, when we'd given up all hope of being picked up that evening by anything, someone noticed over the horizon a ship's mast sticking up. And it got larger and larger until it came into the shape of a white-painted ship. As it got nearer, we saw that it was a hospital ship, an Italian hospital ship. And she came up near us, heaved to, put down boats, and they came over to us and started loading up. Well, there was a big scramble by the ship's company, those are the ship's company anyway, that were not wounded, to get on board these boats. And this is where the skipper stood up on his little bit of Carly raft, drew his revolver, and said, "Wounded first. I'll shoot the first man that I see crawl aboard one of those boats who is not wounded." And he meant it. And so the wounded were piled in, first of all, and the boats did a shuttle service between us and the hospital ship. But before any of us were picked up, and this takes a bit of believing, but I can assure you that it is perfectly true. While the boats were making towards us, two Italian dive bombers came out of the sky, dropped the bombs near the ship, and machine gunned us in the water. Fortunately, Italian gunners being very bad marksmen, they didn't hit anybody, and neither did the bombs. But as this was taking place, then we noticed two more planes come out of nowhere, and they were German fighters, and they drove off the Italian dive bombers. So we got through that little episode unscathed. Anyway, eventually, by about 10 o'clock, everybody had been hoisted inboard into the hospital ship. We were all standing on the quarter deck, ordered to strip off, starkers, just take photographs, watches, any money that we had and that sort of thing. Our clothes were then all collected up and thrown over the side. And the wounded were taken down to the sick bay in the ship, which wasn't very big because it wasn't a very big ship. And there were about 40 of us stowed in this very small sick bay. No treatment was given to us, no food and no water. We were just standing there, starkers, wondering what was going to happen next. Those who were not wounded were taken to another part of the ship and presumably put behind locked doors. The ship got underway, and the next morning, I think round about 7 o'clock, we arrived at Pantelleria, where lorries were on the jetty. They loaded up the wounded, took them up to the infirmaria, or hospital, as we would call it in this country. It wasn't a very big one. The rest of the ship's company, who were all right, were given a blanket to throw round themselves, marched through the little village of Pantelleria, out to some huts on the foreshore, I understand, where they were locked up. Now, I don't know what happened to them from then onwards. I can only go on what happened to us in hospital. When we got into hospital, there was only one doctor there, and his name was Dr. Luigi, and I shall never forget him. And the nurses were nuns. We were all put into bed, all covered in oil fuel. You can imagine what sort of a state and a mess we were in. We were just put into bed. Dr. Luigi came round, had a look at each and every one of us to find out who needed his attention. And from then onwards, from time to time, various bodies were carted off to some other part of the hospital. And they came back either all stitched up or bandaged up or what have you. And in one or two cases, in the ward I was in, the doctor came round with a scalpel and he did minor operations while the chap was in bed. He had virtually no anaesthetics. He only had one scalpel, and that wasn't very sharp, apparently. He had practically no bandages or plaster. In fact, he had practically nothing. He was very badly off for medical equipment. There was no X-ray machine or anything like that. However, knowing that we were English, he sent out to the local restaurant and got some food brought in to us from that restaurant. And apparently he asked them to make it as near to an English-type meal as they could. But, of course, they couldn't. It had to be spaghetti. He also went, apparently, to the local chemist and he bought a toothbrush and a tube of toothpaste for each one of us and came round and presented it to us, which was very good of him because it all came out of his own pocket, we understood. He was a very good doctor, a poor little Italian, who was trying to do his best with virtually no equipment. And we all appreciated what he was trying to do for us. However, the next morning, we heard thumping of boots, and in came the doctor, followed by Italian naval officers and some Germans. And he was cackling away in Italian, telling them all about us and that we were the ship's company of the Bedouin. They'd been picked up the previous evening. And the captain, the naval captain, I can't remember his name, but he was the captain of the Montague Colley, which was the senior officer of the Italian fleet, with whom we'd been in battle the previous day. And the Germans were, we were told, the gunners on the Italian ships, because while the action was going on, we just could not understand how Italian ships could hit us so accurately in such a short space of time. But when the Germans came round to the hospital and we were informed that they were the gunners on the cruisers, then we understood why. They had German gunners.
So the Italian naval gunnery didn't have a very good reputation in the Royal Navy?
No, no, it didn't. And I'll give you another example of that later on after I left hospital. On the third day that we were in the hospital, we were each brought a very small piece of what they called soap. It was green in colour and the texture was like pumice stone. It was about 2 inches long, half an inch thick, and about an inch and a quarter wide. And we were told to go along to the showers, which were cold water, and try and clean ourselves up as best we could with this little tiny piece of, well, one might just as well call it pumice stone and finish with it, because it wasn't soap. No way could it have been soap. Well, we went along there three at a time and did the best we could, but of course with this particular stuff, oil fuel being what it is, we weren't very successful at all. We just came back, got in our beds again, and left it at that. Well, after 10 days, I and several others were fit enough to be moved. So, one morning they came in and they dished us out with American white duck sailor suits with an American sailor's hat as well and some Italian army boots. And we were taken from the hospital by lorry down to the jetty and put into a ship called the City of Trapani. And we were transported then from Pantelleria over to Trapani in Sicily. Now, in 1940, Mussolini had opened a brand new hospital on the outskirts of Trapani, and this is where we were taken, and it was an absolutely superb place. They had all the latest equipment there, particularly for X-raying, as I will come to in my own case a little bit later on. But we were put in bed there, and we were given some decent soap this time and taken to the bathrooms, and we managed to get ourselves clean, flesh-wise, but of course our hair was all still matted with oil fill. So, later the same day, a couple of Italians appeared in the ward with hair clippers, and one at a time we were sat in a chair and all our hair was clipped off. We didn't go much on this, but really it was the only way to deal with the mess that our hair was in. It was just solid oil fill. Anyway, this was all clipped off, and there we were, Yul Brynner's. Then, after I'd been in there for a few days, one morning I woke up, and had no feeling in my legs from the waist downwards. And when Surgeon Lieutenant Mooney came round to see if we were all right, I mentioned this to him. He mentioned it to the Italian interpreter, who mentioned it to the director of the hospital. That's what they called the senior medical officer in their hospital, apparently, the director. And before long, I found myself being whipped down to an X-ray room, where, as I said, they had all the latest equipment. It was beautiful stuff. And they X-rayed me from top to bottom because they thought that there might still be a piece of shrapnel left in me which had made a delayed action. They couldn't find anything. And after a few days, the numbness left my legs and everything was all right again. Well, now, we stayed in there, I think, for about another 10 to 14 days until we were even fitter to move. And then a number of us were once again taken out of the hospital, put into a lorry, and then taken into the heart of Sicily to a place called Castelvetrano, where they had a concentration camp and where the rest of the ship's company were. The officers were in one compound and the ratings in another, and we were all under canvas. In this camp, we were put to work every day. There were working parties. Well, now, you know, we were not averse to this because we found that going out on working parties, it meant extra food, because all we had to eat at this place was a dixie full of watery vegetable stew and, you can't call it a loaf of bread, about 126 grams of bread, which is about our equivalent of a penny bun. And that's all we had to eat every day. So when we knew that there was food on the end of a working party, and we knew when they called out for volunteers for a working party, there was one big mad rush to get to the front of the queue to get taken on. And we used to be taken out onto the farms where at this time of the year they were thrashing the corn. And we worked stacking up the corn, cleaning up the yard, getting rid of the chaff, bagging the grain, whatever job there was going. And we worked at this for about 4 hours in the forenoon, from about 7 o'clock in the morning till 11 o'clock. When we'd finished the job, we used to be taken round to the farmer's house, and he'd come out with a big fanny full, or big container full, of about 2 gallons of wine, usually white wine, some bread, some onions, and some cheese, and he would give each of us a ration, and we would sit down there and then and eat it before we got back to the camp. Now, this was just the job. Well, now, one day we were taken out on a working party into a field where we saw a lot of stuff, something like oats growing, as far as I can remember. One of the chaps, a petty officer with the name of Tubby Catcliffe, he recognised this for linseed. So we put our heads together and said, we're not going to pick that. We went on strike because linseed could be used for making munitions. And this was against the Geneva Conventions. So we refused to pick it. The major, the Italian major, who was in charge of us, immediately drew his .38 little revolver and started threatening us with it. So this big petty officer, Tubby Catcliffe, stalked across to him in a very menacing manner. He backed away and he put his little revolver back in its holster and said, "Avante, avante, avante," which meant forward, we finished for the day, because we refused to pick this linseed, and we were never taken back to that field again. But he got his own back on us, because the next day we were taken out onto the hillsides. This camp was in a sort of valley. There was a little stream ran through it, and all round the valley, well, it was like a cup, really, a very shallow cup. All round the top of the cup, so to speak, were the guards placed, 20 of them. Well, as I say, the next day, the Italian major got his back, his own back on us by sending us up these fields to the top of the rim of the cup, so to speak, and we had to pick up stones, mainly flints, in wicker baskets and take them down to where they were building a road, these stones to be used as hardcore. Now, this was a very monotonous and soul-destroying job, just walking up these hillsides, filling your basket with stones, taking them down again, pouring them out on the road, back up the hill again for 4 or 5 hours. However, we had no choice. We were prisoners, so we had to do it. Well, now, while we were in this camp, a lot of us, myself included, went down with diarrhea. Now, at night, because we got so many ants and other creepy, crawly things by sleeping under canvas, on the ground, with no ground sheets or anything like that, all we had was a blanket, we had to dress up in our full sailor suit to keep these things out as best we could. And, as I've just said, a number of us, myself included, got a dose of diarrhoea. Now, our heads, as we call them in the Navy, or toilets in Civvy Street, was a slit trench way down at the bottom of the valley with just a pole across it. Nothing else, no covering, nothing. And at night, if you were taken short and wanted to go down to the toilet, you had to call the guard who was stationed at the entrance to the tent, and he was supposed to light you down to the toilet with his hurricane lamp. Well, I needed to go to the toilet one night, and I called the guard when I got to the entrance to the tent and tried to make him understand that I needed to go to the toilet. And I think he got the message. But what he didn't do was light me with his hurricane lamp to the toilet. He told me, "Avanti, avanti, avanti." Well, I couldn't stand and argue. So I started to make a beeline for the toilets across the compound, when all of a sudden, all hell was let loose. There were bullets flying all over the place. And I flattened out on the deck quicker than that. And the next morning, I went over to the officer's compound and asked if I could see our skipper. He came out and I told him what had happened. And he said, "All right, Macy, I'll see the Italian major and get this thing sorted out." Because I didn't like having 20 Italians trying to shoot me down in the middle of the night. I already got two holes in my back. I didn't want any more. 24 hours later, I was out in the compound and the captain called me across to the dividing wire between us. He said, "Well, Macy, I saw the Italian major yesterday. I told him what had happened. He's interrogated his guards. The story that he's come up with is that they were shooting at a dog." I said, "Thank you very much, sir. An English pig dog, I suppose." Now, as I've said, in the hospital in Pantelleria, the poor old doctor there, he didn't have very much in the way of equipment, dressings or anything like that. Well, now, I came across another example of this in this camp in Castelvetrano. Every morning, one of the Italians would come and shout at the wire or at the gate, "All the sixes, all the sixes, all the sixes." What he meant was all the sick. So those of us who still had open wounds and that sort of thing, we used to go through into the first aid tent. Well, one morning, I just could not believe my eyes. When he came to deal with me, he stripped the plaster off from my back, the two holes in my back, and he dropped the plaster with the soiled lint in a bin. And he cleaned up the wounds. And I think he put some cream or something like that on them. I don't know. I seem to remember something like that. And then he looked around for some clean lint and some new plaster to put back on my back. And apparently he hadn't got any. All he'd got was clean lint. So he cut two pieces of clean lint, and then lo and behold, he took the old plaster out of the bin, took the soiled lint off that, got a match, lit it, held it under the plaster to make it sticky, and then smacked that back on my back. And that's perfectly true. They had nothing there. However, I think that's enough about Castelvetrano. We then soldiered on in this camp for about 3 weeks, as far as I can remember, when one morning we were told that we were going to be taken to a big camp in Italy, a proper POW camp. So we thought, well, that's good. At least we're getting somewhere. We get perhaps some better food. So they marched us from Castel Vetrano to Trapani. And we discovered later it was right through brigand country. We didn't know at the time. However, we got to Trapani, no bother. We were put on a ship, taken to Reggio Calabria in the toe of Italy.